You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is The Distinction: What the Fed Knew About the Line Between Supply Shock and Inflation Regime. Janet Yellen arrived in Hong Kong on the second day of the HSBC Global Investment Summit under conditions that her own framework was designed to address. The summit convened against a backdrop of oil price volatility and equity market unease, the kind of external supply shock that Yellen, across three decades at the Federal Reserve, had built a framework to address. Patient in posture, attentive to whether the shock would pass before expectations moved. She was the last person in the room who needed the situation explained. Her credentials at this moment are without parallel. As Fed Chair from 2014 to 2018, she championed key elements of the analytical framework the current FOMC still relies on: the look-through logic for supply shocks conditional on anchored expectations, the strong preference for gradualism under uncertainty, and the dual mandate weighting that institutionalizes concern for employment outcomes. When the committee decides today to look through a price spike rather than react to it, the conceptual tools draw heavily on the architecture she helped establish. When she speaks in Hong Kong, she is not commenting on the institution from outside. She is describing the framework as its architect. The proximity is doubled by her subsequent role. As Treasury Secretary through early 2025, Yellen occupied the intersection of fiscal and monetary authority long enough to understand precisely how political pressure on the Fed is transmitted and where its limits lie. Her presence at a summit podium now constrains the administration's room to escalate. She remains a figure of sufficient institutional gravity that her public assessments carry weight in the markets the administration is watching. On stage, she sounded exactly as one would expect: measured, qualified, careful with the language of probability. Her guess, she said, was that maybe there would be a cut later in the year. That carefulness is not incidental. It reflects a specific analytical claim that the Fed can distinguish this supply shock from a broader inflation regime and calibrate accordingly. That claim is testable against the Fed's own documentary record. We went into the archives. The distinction that dissolves. The supply versus demand distinction is theoretically valid. No serious economist disputes that an Iran-driven oil price spike constitutes a supply shock rather than a demand impulse. The question the archive answers is whether that distinction functions as an operational guide to policy in real time, or whether it dissolves before the committee can act on it. Yellen's formulation at the HSBC summit carried the full weight of that theoretical confidence. "This is really a broad supply shock," she said, "a diagnostic classification that, if correct, authorizes a specific response. Patience is warranted. Aggressive tightening would be an overcorrection." The classification does not merely describe the shock, it licenses a posture. The record is consistent across episodes. Board staff characterized the real-time identification of supply shocks as an error-prone process, language that circulated internally while public communications projected the framework as a confident guide. Esther George captured the difficulty in 2021. "One lesson from the history of oil price movements is that it can be very difficult to disentangle the role of supply versus demand. Prices are determined by the intersection of supply and demand, and the price impact of any particular supply disruption will depend importantly on the underlying strength of demand. Supply and demand interact at the price level, and separating the two forces requires assumptions about underlying conditions that cannot be confirmed before the policy window closes." George herself later acknowledged that disruptions initially classified as temporary now look as if they may be more long-lasting. The classification had shifted, the posture had not.
What the archive documents about internal uncertainty stands in sharp contrast to the public register. Staff characterized the real-time classification process as error-prone. Committee deliberations recorded persistent uncertainty about whether a given price movement was transient or embedded, public communications projected the framework as a confident diagnostic guide. The gap between internal assessment and external register is documented across multiple sources, a difference not just of emphasis, but of operational candor, where internal work was more explicit about fragility, while public messaging was more confidence-preserving. The institution knew more about the framework's fragility than it communicated to markets, to Congress, or to the public. William Poole, then president of the St. Louis Fed, identified a deeper inversion in the framework's logic. In summary, maintenance of low inflation over a period of several years or more is achievable whatever happens to oil prices. The same was true in the 1970s, and the fact that inflation was high on average reflected over-expansionary monetary policy, not the oil shocks. Poole's argument reframes the diagnostic entirely. The supply shock is not the inflation. The policy response to the supply shock is the inflation. The Volcker-era lesson Poole draws on, and examined in the assay, is not that the supply-demand classification was abandoned, but that monetary policy must prevent accommodation from turning a relative price shock into trend inflation. The 1970s failure was not that the shocks were misclassified, it was that the policy response accommodated them. The distinction Yellen invokes does not resolve the question of the correct response. It defers it. In 2022, Mary Daly, president of the San Francisco Fed, offered the closest contemporary parallel to Yellen's current posture. The Federal Reserve would not repeat the 1970s because the institution is different. Not the people, but the practices and beliefs that govern behavior under pressure. The argument was institutional rather than analytical. It asserted the institution had changed enough to catch the failure before it embedded. The archive documents that the classification provided what staff analyses later described as false confidence in both the 1970s and 2021-22. The institution classifying correctly in theory while watching inflation embed in practice. The strongest counterposition to this reading is the one Eric Rosengren articulated in 2011. Supply shocks may be transitory precisely because of how monetary policy responds to them. On that argument, the failure is not in the distinction itself, but in the credibility of the reaction function. If the committee demonstrates it will tighten at the first sign of second-round effects, the shock remains transitory because the market believes it will. That is a conditional claim, and it is a serious one. It implies that what the archive documents is not the inherent inoperability of the supply shock framework, but the institutional conditions under which the framework's preconditions cannot be met. Specifically, the episodes in which intense political and distributional pressure prevented the committee from executing the reaction function that would have made the classification valid. Under those conditions, the distinction has been difficult to operationalize quickly enough to prevent second-round effects, not because the analytical category is unsound, but because the credibility of the response was itself compromised before the window closed. Mary Daly's 2022 argument that the Fed would not repeat the 1970s because the institution had changed its practices and beliefs was the contemporary version of Rosengren's conditional. The distinction works if the institution is capable of the response. What the archive tests is whether that institutional capacity was present when it was claimed. The staff characterization of the real-time classification as an error-prone process and Esther George's acknowledgement that disruptions initially classified as temporary now look as if they may be more long-lasting document the gap between the institutional change hypothesis and what the institution actually produced under pressure. The distinction did not fail as an abstraction. It failed in the interval between classification and action, in the specific episodes where the political and distributional stakes were highest. If the distinction dissolves under those historically recurrent conditions, then any framework that depends on it requires a guardrail to catch the failure before it embeds. What guardrail does Yellen invoke? The guardrail that lags. If the supply shock distinction dissolves before the committee can act on it, the framework requires a secondary indicator to confirm the price spike has not embedded. At the HSBC summit, Yellen referenced short-term expectations and broad data watching. Short-term inflation expectations are up slightly, but they're going to watch all of that very carefully. That formulation signals monitoring across multiple indicators, not a single threshold, but attentiveness to the full range of data as it arrives. The specific architecture in which long-run expectations anchoring serves as the operative precondition for look-through policy comes from her earlier work as chair, not from the summit stage itself. But the framework she built, and that the current committee still relies on, does assign that anchoring function a central role. The guardrail that licenses patience so long as it holds. The architecture is Yellen's own. In September 2015, speaking as chair, she laid out the logical structure. From the Janet Yellen, the central bank can look through such short-run inflationary disturbances in setting monetary policy, allowing it to focus on returning the economy to full employment without placing price stability at risk. The precondition for look through is the anchor. If long-run expectations move, the license disappears. If they hold, the committee can wait. The framework's license for patient policy depends critically on the apparent stability of longer-run expectations measures, surveys, market-based break-evens, and their convergence, despite internal recognition that these measures can be slow-moving and hard to interpret in real time. The archive tracks that instrument across three decades of internal research. Board staff assessments from 1993 through 2014 classified long-run inflation expectations survey metrics as suspect, fragile, and backward-looking lagging indicators rather than reliable measures of forward-looking credibility. The institution possessed its own evidence, accumulated across multiple research cycles, that the guardrail was measuring the past rather than forecasting the future. A pattern of measurement choices serving institutional convenience that, the measure, documented in the selection of the inflation gauge itself. This internal assessment did not surface in public communications. When long-run expectations remained stable during the 2021 inflation surge, the stability was characterized publicly as confirmation that the supply shock framework was working. John C. Williams, then president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, offered a different description of the same phenomenon. From the John C. Williams, over the past year and a half, measures of longer-run inflation expectations have been insensitive to the rapid rise in inflation.
Insensitive. The word carries both readings simultaneously. In public communications, insensitivity to rising inflation became evidence of anchoring, proof the guardrail held. In the staff record, insensitivity is consistent with what a lagging indicator would look like during a regime transition. It may not move because it is measuring the past, not because the future is secure. That reading is the Post's analytical inference from the staff characterizations of expectations metrics as backward-looking, not a conclusion staff explicitly drew in those terms, but it is the inference the documented pattern supports. Williams himself delivered that observation in a public speech, which complicates any clean internal-external divide. The ambiguity he named was not confined to internal deliberations, but had entered the institution's public register. The same data point, expectations did not rise, warranted internal caution and externally justified patience. These are not compatible conclusions drawn from ambiguous evidence. They are opposite conclusions drawn from identical data, filtered through the register in which they were spoken. The committee deployed a concept that meant three different things depending on where in the institution it was spoken. Staff used anchored expectations with explicit reservations. The committee used them as an intellectual scaffold for patience. Public communications used them as proof of credibility. None of these readings converged at the moment the distinction required them to. The framework has now lost two pillars. the supply shock distinction dissolves in real time. The guardrail that monitors it is backward-looking by the institution's own documented assessment. What remains in Yellen's argument at the HSBC summit is structural rather than diagnostic. The independence of the institution as the precondition for any of this to work. The pressure that recurs. The claim that now carries the entire analytical weight, that independent judgment can preserve the supply shock distinction when political pressure is greatest, rests on a premise Yellen states with unusual directness. I have never seen a threat of this level to the Fed before. That claim is plausible on its own terms. The form of direct presidential coercion she describes may be genuinely novel in its visibility and intensity. But the underlying dynamic, political pressure constraining monetary policy, has deep roots in the institutional record. The archive does not rebut Yellen's claim about the current level. It shows something more consequential. The institution's documented response patterns under that pressure, which is precisely what makes the current episode more dangerous, not less. The historical record does not offer reassurance. It offers a precedent for how the institution has previously failed to hold the line it publicly proclaimed. The test begins in 1951. Mariner Eccles, as the accord took shape, described the precise logic that had subordinated Fed policy to fiscal objectives for a decade. From the Mariner S. Eccles, the Treasury's primary responsibility is that of financing the operations of the government at the lowest possible cost at which it can induce the public to absorb its debt. This was not Eccles endorsing the Treasury's position. It was Eccles naming the logic Yellen now describes as belonging to banana republics. The pressure to set rates in service of debt service costs is not a modern aberration. It is the oldest form of fiscal monetary conflict in the American institutional record, and the accord itself exists because that pressure succeeded for a decade before it was resolved. The 19th century pattern might be dismissed as pre-modern. The transcripts will not permit that dismissal. In December 1989, with the committee debating how far to push disinflation, Edward Boehner put the political constraint on the table without euphemism. From the Edward G. Boehner, I don't think there is a public or political mandate to go to zero inflation if it means pushing up unemployment and risking a recession. Every chairman of the Federal Reserve has had stronger rhetoric against inflation than, in effect, we have been practically able to deliver. The gap between rhetoric and delivery is precisely what the archive documents across multiple institutional regimes. And the mechanism producing that gap was identified in the same transcript by Richard Syron.
From the Richard Syron, what I think is the real issue here, and several people have alluded to it, is the issue of political acceptability. Political acceptability. Not staff projections, not the measurement problems that make the supply shock distinction analytically difficult. The binding constraint on tightening was what the political environment would absorb. And committee members said so explicitly, behind closed doors, in language that never appeared in public communications. Two propositions emerge from this record, and they carry different levels of evidentiary support. What the archive documents directly. Political constraints on tightening are a recurring feature of the deliberative record. Bain and Syron named political acceptability as a binding constraint on disinflation, explicitly, behind closed doors, in language that never appeared in public communications. The deliberative record is more candid about that constraint than the public record, which translated the same deliberation into the language of analytical judgment. What the archive supports as inference, but cannot document as intention. Under those constraints, the supply shock classification becomes analytically attractive because it provides a defensible rationale for the posture the political environment requires. Whether that alignment is coincidental or instrumental, whether the classification provides cover or merely coincides with constraint, the archive cannot definitively resolve. No committee member in the transcripts reviewed explicitly linked the political constraint to the public framing of inflation as cost push or supply driven. but the pattern recurs with sufficient regularity across episodes separated by decades to warrant structural concern rather than dismissal as coincidence. William Poole identified the structural vulnerability this pattern creates. The filters used to separate inflation signals from inflation noise, he argued, may not be robust to changes in monetary policy regimes. When the political regime shifts, the analytical filters are exposed to the same pressure, and the institution may mistake the accommodation the political environment required for the analytical discovery the framework produced. This is the mechanism that makes Yellen's two claims structurally inseparable in a way the archive has already measured. The supply shock distinction has not historically failed because of analytical error alone. It has failed because political pressure found the distinction's ambiguity and occupied it. Because the cost-push framing was the intellectually defensible position that happened to align with the politically survivable one. If that alignment is now operating again, and Yellen's own account of the pressure's intensity suggests it may be, the archive documents precisely what the framework produces under those conditions. The patience the framework produces. What the framework produces under these conditions is, at its core, the most human of arguments in Yellen's repertoire. Workers suffer during supply shocks in ways that are immediate and concrete. Real wages fall as energy costs rise, employment softens, and the people least positioned to absorb income losses absorb them first. The dual mandate exists to institutionalize that reality, to require the committee to weigh employment outcomes rather than treat inflation as the sole objective. When Yellen says, "If I had to write one thing down on a piece of paper, if I'm going into the next FOMC meeting where the forecasts are produced, I suppose my guess would be that maybe there would be a cut later in the year," she is not being reckless. She is hedging across three successive conditionals: a guess, a maybe, a later, before arriving at one cut. The qualification is extensive. The caution is genuine. This is the human argument inside the analytical framework. Over-tightening into a supply-driven price spike punishes workers already absorbing real income losses from higher energy costs. The archive confirms the argument's sincerity. It also documents a recurring pattern. In 2012, deliberating over additional accommodation against sluggish recovery, Narayana Kochalakota named the mechanism directly.
From the Narayana Kochalakota, "I suggested in the economic go-round that additional accommodation would be largely trying to offset a supply shock. And because we're facing a supply shock, we face a traditional dual mandate conflict. Using policy to lower the unemployment rate well below 8% will require PCE core inflation to rise above target." The dual mandate conflict was named. The trade-off was quantified. The committee accommodated anyway. 2 years later, a staff briefing examining the inflationary risks of sustained accommodation supplied a more precise warning. From the staff analysis, "Accommodation may bring about a much larger inflationary episode than these models view as likely." The phrase identifies a specific structural deficiency. The models generating the committee's baseline forecasts were built to underestimate the inflationary tail of accommodation. The committee, using those models, consistently concluded the tail risk was manageable. The internal registers quantify the divergence. Staff confidence in the safety of accommodating through supply shocks scored 38. Committee deliberation scored 30, while public communications projected 70. The widest gap the archive documents, meaning the institution's own assessment identified the danger, while public messaging more than doubled the confidence level. What produced that conclusion across meeting after meeting was not a sequence of independent judgments. The 2016 Teal Book loss function specification describes the architecture. From the Federal Reserve Board staff, "The loss function also penalizes changes in the federal funds rate, thus embodying a preference for policy gradualism. This feature of the loss function may reflect a variety of non-modeled concerns, such as caution associated with uncertainty about the structure and the state of the economy. Staff optimal control exercises built gradualism into the baseline. The loss function penalized rate changes, ensuring that recommended paths tilted toward inertia under uncertainty. Under this specification, sufficiently patient policy emerged as optimal for any scenario where the supply shock classification held, even imperfectly, even with significant tail risk, creating a modeling environment where the recommended path reinforced the analytical prior. Whether that modeling bias carried into actual committee decisions is a question the archive can support only where meeting discussions document participants citing optimal control results. The structural preference for gradualism is what the specification establishes, not a mechanical institutional commitment. In September 2021, as goods inflation accelerated and supply chain disruptions extended well past initial projections, Governor Lael Brainard articulated the public posture in terms structurally identical to Yellen's 2026 framing. The currently elevated level of inflation is driven by COVID-related disruptions. As these COVID-related disruptions subside, most forecasters expect inflation to move back down toward the Federal Reserve's 2% long-run objective on its own. The supply shock classification held. The look-through continued. The framework performed exactly as specified. The inflation that followed was the worst overshoot in four decades. Yellen has correctly identified every element the archive documents as the precursor to that failure. The distinction's fragility under sustained pressure, the guardrail's dependence on lagging measures, the political alignment's corrupting force. Her prescription, patience, and perhaps a cut, is the contemporary expression of the same analytical posture the archive traces through every completed cycle. The framework contains no defined threshold for when its own patience becomes the error.
Yellen in Hong Kong is the architect returned to the structure she built, watching the same sequence reassemble under new pressure. The supply shock is different, the political environment is sharper, the institutional stakes are higher. The framework's structural tendencies are the same preference for patience, the same reliance on expectations metrics that the institution's own staff characterized as backward-looking, the same political incentive to classify ambiguity as supply-driven. The macro conditions of a pure external commodity shock are not equivalent to the mixed demand-supply disruptions of 2021-22, and the Post does not treat them as such. What recurs across those materially different settings is not the shock, but the framework's characteristic response to it. The archive does not reveal an institution that misread the risks she described from the summit stage. It reveals an institution that understood them precisely, that knew supply shocks were transient, that tracked expectations with care, that internally acknowledged the ambiguity between looked-through inflation and embedded inflation, and still traveled the full distance from patient posture to corrective shock. Not once, repeatedly. The pattern is not the failure of the framework to be understood. It is the consequence of the framework being applied. What the archive shows, taken together, is this. Every analytical element Yellen affirmed in Hong Kong has documentary support. The distinction between supply and demand shocks is real. Expectations matter. Independence is the precondition. None of those claims is wrong. And none of them, singly or together, has historically been sufficient to define the moment when patience ends and persistence begins. The threshold the framework has never specified, because specifying it would require the institution to pre-commit in exactly the way that discretionary judgment is designed to avoid. Yellen knows this. The carefulness of her phrasing, a guess maybe later in the year, is not evasion. It is the precision of someone who has operated at the center of the cycle and understands what the framework can and cannot hold. The distinction between supply-driven and demand-driven inflation holds in theory and dissolves in the interval the committee must cross on its own. She built the tools. The archive shows what the tools produce, and the architect, on stage in Hong Kong,
reaffirms the distinction with full knowledge of what carrying it forward requires. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.